So our first speaker is Kina Martinez, and she's a medical doctor and has worked with drug addicts and some different things and how the brain works and whether you can retrain a brain and all that, and so we will turn it over to her.
Great, thank you. That's not working. Sorry, as I make my computer work. There we go. So as he said, I'm Sister Kina Martinez. I go to the South Bend Church. I'm married to Joshua. We have four boys, ages 12 to almost 19 now. And I do work as a family physician. And so one of the things I discovered as I got into my job, that one of the challenges that they did not really train me for in medical school was how to find out where people are and meet them where they are so that we could move to a place of better health. And that sounds really easy, but when you start working with people who did not grow up like you did, who have been exposed to very different life experiences, it opens up this completely different challenge in terms of how to connect and understand someone who responds to decisions or makes decisions that otherwise you think, why would you do that? Or where are you coming from? Or I really can't understand that. And the intuitive playbook is a concept that I use that kind of takes some brain science and simplifies it, hopefully, into a really understandable way for how we make decisions and why we make some of the decisions that we do. And I find that this terminology and kind of understanding this in how our brains work understands me or helps me understand myself better, so I can kind of see, like, ooh, this is where I'm coming from and this is why I'm responding this way, but also why other people respond the way they do. So again, I can meet them where they are and walk with them to a place of greater health and deeper healing. And I hope this is helpful to you also. So this slide is a little bit out of order. If you're following your books, these definitions come later, but you do have them. So what is the intuitive playbook? It's basically a mental process that runs our instinctive automatic decision making. Using it makes life easier. It's kind of a shortcut for making decisions that we can use without really having to think about it or engage our conscious, rational decision making process, which is great because a lot of situations we don't have time to go through the slow steps of analyzing everything that's going on. Will die. The lion will get you before you can figure out that that's what that shadow is. So it's wonderful that God gave us this process. It basically uses our past experiences and how those things made us feel as a guide for future decision making. It is a record in a sense of how the world appears to us based on what we've lived through and what has happened to us in the past. And it uses those experiences to guide us in order to minimize bad feelings like pain, hunger, distress, loneliness, fear, all of those things, and to kind of maximize the positive or keep us in balance in our body. So we could say that the intuitive playbook, and I'll just read the definition, is our subconscious intuition, and it launches our reactions and automatic judgments, both on people and situations, based on our past experiences. An intuitive play is the specific instinctive or gut reaction based on what has previously produced an immediate neurobiologically desirable result, which is kind of wordy, but it's basically saying, in this situation, I respond this way based on this that has happened to me in the past. And we could say that running a play is basically when we do whatever our playbook says without really thinking about it. And we may be completely unaware of that and not even paying attention to it, and it just kind of flows in the background of our mind and takes care of things, doing what feels natural and what feels instinctive to us. So it kind of works like this. Our actions, our sensations, which we could say are our feelings, but even more than that, sensations can be hunger, cold, pain, all of that stuff that's into our bodies, and then our prior experiences. So let's say we have a toddler who notices the stove is on and mom is cooking, and it's making this interesting sizzling noise, and it smells good, and he's curious, and he goes over there and he reaches up for that. And when he does that, he gets a really bad sensation, because either he burns himself or mom yells, no, with this fear and panic in her voice, or it clatters to the ground and makes a big scary sound. And so it's like, ooh, that's a bad sensation. And the brain records that. This burny, sizzly noise on the stove and the heat is badness. Remember, this makes bad things happen. So now some other day, same thing, mom's cooking, pan is sizzling, and his brain will take that information in and run it through the playbook and say, have I felt this before? Is there anything here to guide my reaction? And his brain will go, oh yes, this is associated with bad feelings. And the child will actually feel a little bit of those bad feelings again, which will then prompt him to stay away. Avoid the stove. If he backs away from the stove and goes somewhere else, that bad feeling goes down and he feels better, and it reinforces the play. So plays are the individual actions we have found immediately effective, meaning it's right now the result is. Not 5 years from now, not 2 hours from now, but right now it works to make the bad feelings go away. So I avoid the stove because I've experienced being burned. I don't trust people because they have let me down. I am anxious or overly aggressive because I have experienced the world as a bad, dangerous place, and I either have to hide to protect myself or I have to be more assertive to assert my boundaries and make sure that I'm not harmed. So the brain is always rational. It is always rational, even when we don't understand it. And if we understand the feelings or sensations that are feeding into the body and how the body relates that to its past experiences and what the brain remembers about those sensations in the past, then the current behaviors become much more understandable. For instance, we may look at a child who seems to be choosing on purpose to misbehave and say, why would you do that? You get punished. Why would you do that? Well, if we understand that what they are feeling is so much worse than the discipline they get, that the discipline of being like, hey, I notice you, I see you, you have value enough that I'm going to put some boundaries down, is such a relief from the feeling of being invisible and unwanted and uncared for, now the reason they continue to misbehave makes more sense. Or people who cut. Cutting is not about committing suicide. It's about the pain of this incision or this thing I did to myself feels like a relief from the pain of the darkness that is in my soul. And so it makes the bad pain go away. It distracts from the isolation, the loneliness, the anxiety, the whatever it is. And so even though it's harmful or what we would call maladaptive in terms of the playbook, it is effective at making the bad feelings less bad. So plays can be wrong, and this is something that's really important for us to realize. Our brain can learn the wrong lesson. Sometimes what it learns is actually not good for us or not applicable in all the situations in which we find ourselves. Or sometimes we see what we expect to see instead of what's really there. So for instance, I may believe that I am treated differently because I'm a woman or because I'm a different race or I'm a minority, but that's because I have been treated differently before. And now in my interaction with you, I'm going to color that and I'm going to project feelings onto you that you may not have or intentions that may not be there, because that is what I have learned about people based on my past experience. Or the opposite, I may believe that racism isn't an issue and that we have no rights problems because I've never experienced that. I don't feel that way, therefore nobody does. And that can't be your experience because it hasn't been mine. And we do this. The playbook works so much of the time, and we rely on it to make life easy. And we do have to remember, it's not always right. We can overemphasize, and we do overemphasize, our own experiences, especially if those were associated with very strong negative feelings. So for instance, you may eat at a restaurant and love the restaurant, and if you eat there once and you get the stomach flu, you will never eat at that restaurant again. Now, you get the stomach flu from your home cooking, you don't associate it with your own food. Why? Because you eat your own food all the time and you rarely get sick. But the restaurant is a novel experience and the stomach flu was especially bad, so it must have been that food, not that I just got sick because a bug is going around and that's what happens sometimes. So our playbooks are really helpful, but they're also not entirely reliable. The other thing that's important, and I think this is especially important for this group, is that we are primed to develop certain plays from our genetics. So our genetic structure, what we've inherited from our parents, certain personality traits, our gender, male versus female, it changes the way the brain develops as we go through those early stages in the womb. And the environment in the womb already starts to teach the playbook how to respond to life. So if mom grows up or she's in a very stressful environment where there's a lot of danger and chaos, her levels of stress and her hormones and her anxiety to manage that will already start to prime the baby's brain to be prepared to survive in that environment. So even if you take that newborn home from the hospital, they're going to be different from you in ways that you did not expect and anticipate, and very different from your other children, if you have biologic children, who grew up in your womb already acclimating to the environment and pace of the house that you have. The other thing that contributes to the development of our place is the age of the experience or exposure. So prior to the brain completing its maturation process at about age 25, the things that happen to us, especially if they're very bad things, are especially likely to imprint in the brain. And some of this is because our rational decision-making, our maturity, our ability to evaluate and understand what's going on is more limited in children, and those plays are especially formative. So if you have abuse as a young child, if you have neglect as a young child, that may color the rest of your life, no matter how supportive and wonderful and loving everyone else is after that. It is going to be something that's going to be deeply ingrained there. The intensity of the experience, especially if it's a really bad experience. So it may happen one time, but if it was bad enough, the playbook will record that and it will remember it. I had once in the seventh grade one classmate who made a comment about me with my peers standing around. And it's almost the only time anyone has ever said that about me, but I remember it. And I can't say like it scarred me for life. I don't want to over-dramatize it, but I remember it. And it does sit there in the back of my mind as something that colors my perceptions of people in the way I interact with them. So a strongly intense experience. And then the consistency of the experience, because our habits live in the playbook too. So if something happens repeatedly and it's consistent and it kind of goes the same way every time, our brains actually remodel and actually mold to say, oh, we do this often, and those pathways to promote that behavior become faster and stronger. In biologic terms, we call it upregulating the pathway. It's like basically carving a trench in the brain. And so if you imagine, if you have a trench, when it rains, where is the water gonna go? It's gonna go there, because that's the deepest rut. And so the brain is the same way. And all of these different factors contribute to what kinds of plays we form and how strong those plays are and how much they influence our decisions and our behaviors. I do want to emphasize, this process is not bad. God designed this for our good. But the environment in which we find ourselves will shift how helpful or not this is for us. So I want you to take a look at these plants and think about what happened to them, because they look pretty sorry. And just kind of come up with some scenarios in your mind, and I want to tell you a story. So imagine there's a 10-year-old child who has spent the last 6 years of his life living in really horrible circumstances. There has been abuse, there has been neglect, there has been hunger, starvation, illness, danger in all of its forms, from people, from environment, from situations. And at the age of 10, he has been beaten so badly by his caregiver that he is now in the hospital and removed from that environment, and instead placed with a completely different group of people. And in this new environment, he has order, there is peace, there is physical safety, there is consistency and fairness and discipline, there are regular meals, and there is exposure to God. And every day the child thinks, as soon as I'm well, I'm running away. Why? It's because the boy and the plants are experiencing the same thing. Transplant shock. You dig up a plant, it is accustomed to a particular environment. Its playbook is optimized to survive in this environment. And you dig it up and you put it somewhere else. And even though the new environment may be a healthier environment for the plant, it may have the better soil, it may have a richer supply of water, it may be better for that plant's survival, there is a shock when you pick up and dig a plant and move it even across your yard. So kids aren't the only ones that experience transplant shock. We do too as adults. We just have more capacity to deal with it. So I want you to go back to maybe late March of 2020 when COVID was paralyzing the world. Many of us experienced transplant shock. All of a sudden, the world wasn't following the rules. Our playbook didn't work. We didn't know what was happening. Everything was uncertain. And it's hard when all of a sudden, our playbook no longer matches the environment in which we find ourselves. Or maybe you read a lot of wonderful stories about fostering and adoption, and you felt inspired and heartwarmed, and you were going to touch these lives, and you were going to change these kids. And even though it hadn't happened yet, in your brain, it was real, because we use the same processes for storing memory as we do for planning ahead. Our brain is very efficient. And so your imagination about how this was going to be and absorbing the wonderful things that other people told you and the way people said, oh, that family fosters, they're so amazing. Like, I just respect them so much. You had this wonderful idea that this is how this was going to be. And then if you bring that child home and this is what you find, the rock moving, weed pulling, hard day-to-day task, unglamorous grind of loving and serving other people who have sometimes very deep needs, you may find yourself feeling shocked, frustrated, overwhelmed, discouraged, confused. Why? Because when life does not conform to our playbook, it's hard. We can't run on autopilot. We have to think through everything, and it feels uncomfortable. The world doesn't make sense, and even if we can't explain that that's what's going on, we know that we feel like something's not right, and we feel frustrated. So what do we do? What do we do when we find ourselves in this place? Well, we have a choice, and the choice we have to make is how are we going to use the rest of the brain God gave us? So in your packets, the arrow is drawn incorrectly on the second side here. I don't think you could see it, but the arrow goes down and not up this way. So we have the intuitive pathway, the instinctive pathway for decision making, but our minds also have the conscious, intentional, deliberate pathway. And that's a slower pathway, but it's great for making abstract decisions based on information we've not experienced before. So this is where we examine our options. You know, what's going on in the situation? I need to buy a new car. What kind of car do I need? What can I afford? What are the safety features? Do I need good gas mileage? What am I going to use it for? And we can analyze all of these variables, evaluate a different choices available to us, and then we can make a very intentional decision. This process is great for helping us learn new things that we've never done before. You know, how do you learn how to insert, you know, whatever, examine a patient, take a medical history, build something, you follow a recipe? This is what we're using, our conscious, deliberate side of our brain. It does require cognitive effort. So this only works if we're thinking about it and paying attention to it. This side will work no matter what. It just runs all the time, managing our body and our life and taking care of the easy things that we've done before. This side only works if you're paying attention. So if you're kind of mentally checked out or zoned out, you're not doing anything over on the intentional, deliberate side. And we can feel a lot less confident about the decisions we make over here. Because if we're completely leaving the playbook behind and we're just doing this, we may not feel that this is the right decision, or we may not feel confident in the choice that we're making. The two systems, as you can see there, are not isolated. They can and often do work together. So for instance, what do I make for dinner tonight? I'm feeling hungry. Oh, it's time to cook. What do I feel like having? Oh, none of those things are great. What do I have as options in my fridge? And we kind of, can I afford to go out again? And we kind of bounce it back and forth until we make a decision. Do I go to Grafted Gathering? The web, you know, the thing pops in your website, and immediately your body is doing this. How do I feel about going to a big group event across the country? Yay, I love those things. Oh, I'm an introvert. It's kind of draining. Do I want to travel that far? Am I free that weekend? Who would watch the kids? But it would be so wonderful. And our brains do this. They pass the information back and forth until we feel good about the decision we make. Each has its strengths and each has its weaknesses, and there are times that we need to listen to this side, and there are times we need to listen to the other side. And wisdom is in knowing which time is right for which. So when the playbook does not match the environment in which we find ourselves, when we realize that we're frustrated and this just doesn't seem to be working, we have a choice. Do we use the deliberate and intentional side to justify what we feel is right? So this could be things like some of the self-talk. People might say, I just can't change. I just can't change. It's never going to happen. It's impossible. Or, well, it's really not that bad. Like, whatever I'm doing, it's okay, it's justifiable. These are the reasons why I'm really not wrong or it's acceptable to do what I'm doing. It's that other person's fault. If they would just change, I would be fine. So we can do that. We can justify ourselves. In the fostering and adoption community, it might be, I made a mistake. I didn't hear God right. My calling must have been off. I wasn't hearing what he said. Or this kid is hopeless, like there's just nothing that can ever be done. Or I'm not cut out for this, like it's just impossible for me. We can do that. Or we can use our deliberate brain to evaluate and then edit the playbook. So how do we do this? We could call this intentional intuition. This is the process by which we deliberately examine our playbooks and make an effort to change the plays that are there. And I really think this starts by just acknowledging reality for what it is and not for what we wish it was. So instead of trying to imagine that we're still back in this place, the plant going, no, I really am over here. Well, you're not. You're over here. And the sooner you can kind of accept where you are, the easier it's going to be to move forward. Now, I will say that acknowledgement is not resignation. So I spend all day acknowledging that my patients have unhealthy habits and are making poor choices. But that does not mean I believe my patients can never change or can never get better or can never make better choices in the future. Acknowledgement simply puts us in the right frame of mind to effectively evaluate and adapt either our expectations or our approach. There was a time, maybe about 10 years ago or so, when I realized I was getting really frustrated at work. You can probably relate to some of this. You work so hard for people. You put in these long hours. You do all this stuff for them. And then they're not grateful. And they take you for granted. And they leave bad reviews because you were 5 minutes later calling them back than they wanted to. And you just think, really? Like, seriously? I do all of this for you. And that's how you treat me. And so what I had to do is realize I see patients at their worst. When they're sick, when they don't feel good, when they're in pain, when they're afraid, they're vulnerable. Healthcare is confusing. And so you take people into an environment where they have almost no control. And it's not the best situation for most people. And in addition to that, my patients don't see all that I do for them. They don't see the late hours I put in following up on something or calling the specialist or making sure they can get in for whatever. They don't see those things. So the reality is they don't know. They don't know what I'm doing to serve them. They don't know what it's costing me. And just being able to say that, you know what, they just don't see everything I'm pouring into them. That's a healthy place to start. Once you can acknowledge reality, then it's really helpful to notice your own feelings or the feelings that are going on. So what are the sensations? What is it that I'm really feeling? For myself, I was feeling angry. I was feeling frustrated. I was feeling unappreciated. And just calling that out and naming it actually moves the information from this side of the brain to this side of the brain, where now we can engage our deliberate conscious mind and we can pick it apart and analyze it and rationalize it. So you name it, you call it what it is. Once you've noticed how you're feeling, then we start examining the plays. What are my expectations? What have been my past experiences? Where is this reaction coming from? You might say, what do I feel like doing? Why is that? How was I parented? How did my other kids respond? What have I seen in other families or other situations that are similar? What did I imagine this was going to be like? Did I just create something in my mind that maybe wasn't, in fact, reality? So in my experience, I realized the rule in my mind that I was taught was that when others serve you, you should say, thank you. And I was serving people, so they should be grateful, right? Because that's what I was taught. That was the rule in my playbook. And so just realizing, okay, that's where that's coming from. I was taught to say thanks, so I'm serving, I expect thanks. That's why I feel this way. The next thing you should do is evaluate. Evaluate your options. Evaluate your plays. Does my instinct match the current environment? Basically, are my expectations realistic for where I am? Or am I trying to respond, you know, in the Midwest, but really I should be thinking more like China in terms of how I'm responding here. Does my behavior match my instinct, what I feel like doing? Does that match what I say I believe about God? Does it match what I say I believe about fostering? Is my instinct doing this, but that's coming out of my flesh, and God is saying, no, I want you over here instead? So if I look at my experience, my frustration with my patients, Matthew 6:2 is really helpful for me. That's where Jesus says, if you give your alms before men and they praise and notice you, that's all the thanks you're going to get. But if you do it in secret, your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly. And so I had a choice. Do I want the praise of men, which I can work really hard to get and chastise my patients that they're not grateful and tell them you should be saying thankful and drawing attention to all that I'm doing for them? Or do I let that go and say, God, it's okay if nobody notices? Because I trust that you will. And I am going to value more highly your praise than the praise of man. So that's the choice. And once you make that choice, then you need to actually do it. You have to follow through. You see, the playbook is built on our experiences, and so if we just think about it, but we don't do it, the playbook doesn't change. So we have to put it into practice, and this is where it crosses back over. We choose, and then we do it. And we keep doing it, and we keep practicing it, and that will eventually become the new rule in the playbook. So it's a lot like carving a new path in the woods if you want to make a trail. The first time you go down through it, it's like, what happened? You know, it doesn't look like anything happened there. But if you keep walking that same way every day, eventually the ground's going to get hard packed, a little path will appear, the tree branches will start being shorter, you'll be able to like see through it, and a trail will develop. Our brains are exactly the same way. It is completely accurate to say that we become what we repeatedly do. Or even the mantra that's sometimes used, fake it till you make it, it's actually kind of true. You know, I don't feel patient, but I'm going to practice patience, and eventually, it's not so hard. I actually am patient. And look at that. When did that happen? It comes over time. We know in the brain, if you say no to the extra cookie once, it makes it easier to say the next time, no. And the next time, no. Same thing with yes. If I am choosing to get out of bed and exercise in the morning, tomorrow it gets easier. Now, the third day, if I've overdone it, is going to be really hard. So you have to have realistic expectations for your practice. But as you keep doing it, it gets easier and easier, and it becomes automatic, and then you don't have to think about it. It becomes the default. So how do we apply this to the situation of our 10-year-old boy? So reducing transplant shock. I found this picture on the internet. I thought, oh my goodness, it's perfect because it's like the four steps. So the first thing we want to do is increase care for the transplanted child and for ourselves, because it's going to be hard. It is going to be hard, and it's going to be a lot harder than you think, because it's really hard to imagine how hard it's going to be until you're living it, but it's possible, so don't be discouraged by that. So we think about, oh, we're going to cook meals for people who have new babies, and we're going to take maternity or paternity time. And I see a shift increasingly in the adoption and fostering community that we need to have that same sort of understanding that when we bring a child into the home, it's going to take an adjustment. And so are we doing the same thing? Maybe we need to back off on our schedules. Maybe we need to give a little more time for things. Maybe we need to prepare meals ahead so there's not so much stress and we have more mental energy for making those decisions that now we can't rely on our playbook to make for us. The child also needs the same increased care. It's going to be harder for them. It's going to be more difficult for them to function because it's going to be so different from what they've known before. So the next thing we need to do is reduce expectations. So with the plant, we're going to water it more often and we're going to remove all the fruits because the plant cannot keep developing fruit and adapt to the new environment at the same time. It'll expend too much energy and it will die. So we need to reduce expectations for ourselves and pretty much for everybody in the household. So young children will act out. They will. It doesn't mean they're bad kids. It's just now their schedule and routine has been completely upended. The foster child may not be happy. Three meals a day, safe environment, people care. They may not be happy. They may be angry. They may be scared. Reduce your expectations for fruit in this stage. It's not going to come. And if you expect it, you're going to put too much stress on the plant. The adjustment can take a lot longer than we anticipate. And I think a lot of that's because we overlook just how much our playbooks have in common with each other and with any biologic children that we have. You may overlook how different the growing conditions are on one side of your yard versus another. So you pick this plant up and you move it over here and now it's dying. And you didn't anticipate, oh, well, this area is kind of shaded by this tree and the ground underneath it's drier and it's not getting as enough rain. You thought it's the same yard, it'll be okay. But it's not. And so a child from, you know, you and your spouse, if you come both from an AC background, you have a lot of overlap in your playbooks. And the only things you're aware of are the spaces where you're different. Because where you're the same, there's no conflict, there's no trouble. It's routine, it's automatic, and it's easy. So you are not going to be able to anticipate the ways in which your child will be very different from you. Because you won't have experienced it before. It'll be like, where is that coming from? The child's default behavior, their plays and your own, are still going to be there. And under stress and pressure, the brain will revert to what it has done before. And so the point is, we want to decrease the expectations, and we're after persistent practice of better behaviors and habits for ourselves and for the child, not perfection. Perfection is not going to be possible. It will take a lot of time. And you cannot have fruit until the plant or child is reestablished in this environment, and they've set their roots, and everything's growing and going well. The next thing you're going to need to do is protect. And so in this case, you're shading the plant, providing some shade. In the case of a foster or adoptive child, and you guys may have much better experience with this, but the example that comes to mind is try to shield the child from impertinent questions and potentially cruel comments. So in my extended family, there was a family member who grew up in the foster system, eventually got kind of adopted by an AC family and then married and stayed in the AC church, right? And I remember comments the family would make at gatherings. Well, he had an unfit mother. He had an unfit mother. That's why he doesn't have other family in the church. Shield your kids from that. Think about how you're going to explain their background to other people in a way that doesn't shame the child or leave them feeling like there's something wrong with them. Be careful about that. You may need to think through code words that your kid can say when somebody asks them those types of things. Like, I gotta go to the bathroom. Oh, sorry, we're leaving now. Like, you know, give them a way out. Anticipate that, because people don't mean to be unkind. They just don't think, because they haven't experienced it, how their comments may come across. So try to protect the child. And then the last one is you really wanna preserve the healthy roots. So this goes both for us and for the child. When you're blazing a path through the woods, if we go back to that, you don't just want to bulldoze everything. Like, there may be a really beautiful tree, or there may be this nice pond over here, and we don't just want to, like, no, we're going straight, and we're just going to, like, run everything over. And for yourself and for the child, there are going to be roots that are healthy, and we want to preserve those. I like to garden, and when you buy plants, like bare root plants from the nursery, it'll always say, like, trim off the dead and broken roots, and you want to do that, but you want to preserve as many roots as you possibly can, because we all need to feel rooted to something. And if you cut all the roots away, it's going to be really hard for that plant to thrive. Ask God to show you the heart, your heart and your child's heart, and ask him to show you what's important and what isn't. You may have to reevaluate some of your plays and say, you know what, the spotless house, maybe it's just not that important. That's part of my heritage, but I'm gonna let that go. And maybe oven pizza doesn't mean I'm a failure as a mom, right? Like, I'm gonna let go of some of my own roots that may be kind of causing problems. And hold on to the ones that are good and healthy, and ask God to help you understand the difference. We want to, for the kids, maintain good connections to the past, their culture, music, food. You have eyes like your mom did. She was really pretty. Or I hear your dad was very kind or was good with mechanics or whatever it is, whatever you can preserve in their past that is good, that can be used to build them up, try to do that. And as much as you can, maintain a familiar environment. If there are blankets or toys or whatever that they can take with them that will give them a sense of constancy or groundedness, try to incorporate those things where they're healthy. We don't want to include or bring in unhealthy things, but where they're healthy, try to include those things. And where you can, I would also say, include the child in those decisions, because there may be things that are bothersome or comforting to them that you would never consider. So that 10-year-old boy who for 3 years thought of running away is my husband Joshua, for those of you who didn't figure that out already. He has his testimony on AC Central. There are a number of places you can find it. He doesn't like Puerto Rican music. He doesn't like Puerto Rican food. That's where he's from, not Mexico. He's from Puerto Rico. He really doesn't want anything to do with Puerto Rico. People will say, oh, I heard this new Puerto Rican restaurant in town. And he's like, oh, thank you. Never going there. What street is that on so I can avoid it? Because the smells, like, he does not want to be reminded of certain things. Comfort food is a McDonald's Big Mac and ginger ale. Like, that's comfort food. Who would have thought, you know? I could have been like, oh, I'm going to prepare you food from your childhood and make our house wonderful. And he would have been like, I'm going to go throw up now because I just got triggered and this is traumatic for me. So where you can, include the child. What do they like? What do they find comfortable? And see where they're at. I'm going to leave you with a final thought. I think we're right about time, hopefully not over. Joshua lived with a group of Catholic priests. That was his new home environment where he was introduced to stability and order and God. And he lived with them for 7 years, from the ages of 10 to 17. The first 3 years he thought of running away as soon as he was physically strong enough, because he required several surgeries to repair the damage that had been done. And then after about 3 years he realized, okay, this place isn't quite so bad. Maybe I'll ride it out and maybe this will be better than living off the street. But it took him another 3 years after that to really kind of get the hang of it. And so for 6 years he lived with the priests and he had one good year, and then he graduated, aged out, and was gone. And what the priests don't know is the rest of the story, that he kept building on the foundation they helped him reestablish. And he moved from Puerto Rico to California, and he's like, I gotta find better friends, because I'm living in terrible neighborhoods, I'm working with people who, you know, their idea of a Thanksgiving involves a lot of alcohol, and then knife fights in the street, and like the cops are coming, so I need to find better friends. And he found the AC Church. And he noticed dads, like, wow, that dad does something really great, or I like how that family does this, or like, I really admire this thing. And he's like, I'm gonna graft that into my plant. I'm gonna take this piece, I'm gonna take this piece. And he kept building, he kept changing, he kept finding ways to leave his past behind and practice new and better things, because he did not want to stay the way he had been. And one day, one of our boys was maybe about 6 years old and spoke to him in a really sassy, disrespectful tone. And he looked down at his hand and he was like, wow, look at that. That's amazing. The hand did not move. Because in his environment growing up, if he had used those words, like, whoopsh, like it would have been so fast, he wouldn't have even seen it coming, and so instinctive and so automatic. And he was like, whoa, the hand did not move. And that is the power of practicing Christ-likeness, of doing what is righteous over and over and over again, even though it's hard, until we get totally new plays in the playbook. I'm going to leave you with a couple of resources. I think these are in your packets. All Nations is a Bible study with Harvest Call and Onward Media as a collaboration. It's available in the AC bookstore. You can get it in print. You can download it, and the downloadable version is actually usable. Like, you can type in the fields, and you can do the exercises and, like, do it all digitally if you want to do it that way. It's called Nurturing Cross-Cultural Relationships, but really I encourage you to think of cross-cultural as different. Anybody who's different than me, which applies in our marriages, in our families, in our churches, really in any environment where you're going to find somebody whose different experiences have given them different rules in their playbook. The next three are all secular resources. So I'm going to caution you with that, and you're going to have to use your own wisdom and discernment. Inside Transracial Adoption, I think, is a really great resource. I caution especially you moms about reading it, because we're really good at beating ourselves up. And this book asks a lot of really challenging questions. All of my children are biologic, and I read it, and I was like, oh my goodness, I missed this, and I should have been doing that. And so, like, grace if you're going to open this one up. But it gives you some really difficult and hard things to think through, which I think are really important as I work with people who come from different backgrounds and a lot of brokenness and pain in their past. Childhood Disrupted. Talks about adverse childhood events, you know, abuse, neglect, fear, dangerous living situations, and how that affects the way our brains develop and what kind of feels normal to us and kind of the consequences of that. It's written by a patient, so it's very readable if you're not a science-y kind of person like me. It's easy to get through. It does have a couple of situations described, I think, appropriately, but they are disturbing because we're talking about some of the worst things that people go through. So be cautious with that, but it can be very insightful. The Body Keeps the Score is very similar to Childhood Disrupted, but that's for the science-y people. The people are like, I want to see the research, I don't want to see the data, because that one's written by a psychiatrist, so it's much more scientific and medically. But if you like that thing, it's an excellent resource as well. And then you have, I think, printed also your discussion questions, and that's all we've got.